Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Oh, hey. Hey, Grandma, how are you?
I'm pretty good. I have a new cleaning woman today.
Oh, yeah? Obviously, with this pandemic happening, with COVID-19, I'm thinking about past global health crises. And, sorry, one sec. How do I turn this off?
What would you like me to say?
I would just like you to say whatever you want. I'm trying to turn this off. Okay. What precautions have you taken against this virus, the coronavirus?
Well, at home, I have a dish of soap and paper towels right at the back door. Other than that, I don't know that I'm doing a lot. I'm not going to church. Mm. They've told us anybody over 65 doesn't need to come.
Yeah.
No idea. They say the elderly don't have a chance, and they're talking mm-hmm. about 70-year-olds. So I gathered 100 and nearly 101. I hope my immunity is still strong. I'm Kathleen, I'm Margaret Kathleen Burns, nee Maxie, and I was born on April the 24th, 1919, in Misericordia Hospital in Winnipeg, in the middle of the Spanish flu.
So the Spanish flu was a new influenza that hit Canada between 1918 and 1920. It killed 55,000 people in Canada, which is almost the same number of Canadians who were killed in the First World War. In Winnipeg, where my grandma was living, 1,200 people died in a population of approximately 180,000. The Spanish flu was devastating. It caused death, loss of income, major economic disruption, as well as family disruption. And FYI, I'm reading this narration from under a sweater while I'm sitting on my bed at home instead of at a studio because the radio station I work at is shut down. And that's because, as you know, we're in the middle of another great pandemic.
Even though there has been for a long time been this sort of sense that the next one was coming. And you're always told, oh, it's so timely that you write about influenza. It's really only this time that I feel much more as if these two experiences are running together.
Esselt Jones is a professor of history in Winnipeg at the University of Manitoba.
I'm a historian of both infectious disease, especially influenza, and also a historian of socialized medicine.
This past weekend, she wrote a blog post for activehistory.ca about the parallels between the Spanish flu and the current COVID-19 pandemic.
In terms of public health responses, the basic framework for responding to the two experiences is quite similar. So, you know, we see a lot of reliance on prevention and mm-hmm. public education. They were also asked to do all of the things that we're being asked to do right now, you know, school closures, the closures of public gathering places, major events, church services, and so on. So many of those strategies that are being used right now for COVID-19 are very similar strategies to those developed, not just in relation to the 1918 outbreak, but historically in epidemic disease outbreaks.
And you said there were some differences you've observed, though, in the response between these two pandemics.
Yeah.
And what are some of those differences?
Well, in Canada, I think one of the key differences for me is the fact that in 1918-19, there was no Medicare. So when I read, for example, today that, you know, people in the U.S. are concerned about, you know, if I want to get tested, how much will it cost me? Am I going to have to pay for it? If they don't have health insurance, where are they going to go? Are they going to get bills from the hospital at some point? Those are the sorts of questions that people had at the time, right? Because there was no health insurance.
My father was a conductor on the CNR railway.
Mm-hmm.
And he had three children and another one coming very quickly. And of course, he had the children to feed, the mortgage to pay. And so he had to keep working. So he came down with the flu. He caught it on the trains. And he came down with the flu and brought it home. And the three siblings all got it. And my mother nursed them and Dad.
Health messaging in this period was very focused on the individual,
mm-hmm.
not that different from how it is now.
Yeah.
So because women were, you know, in a very gendered society, women were largely responsible for bodily care of the sick,
mm-hmm.
for food, for, you know, cleanliness and all of these things.
And she had no training. No one had any training in those days.
Right. Are women keeping the families clean? Are women feeding the family properly? And so on.
She nursed the children through it and felt she'd saved them.
What happens when you have a large outbreak like that is that it makes it harder for the individual to be the focus.
I know she was very sad for her two sisters who lost their only sons.
And it makes it clear that everyone's kind of in the same boat, right? You know, in that,
mm-hmm.
in a class sense, it enhances people's understanding of a shared health experience. It makes it harder for them to be, for their experience to be framed as an isolated one, separate from their social conditions. In some cases in disease outbreaks, there are, you know, riots or, you know, uprisings that are linked to infectious diseases, cholera, the plague, all of those. Now, I don't see any of that in Canada, but what you do see is a sort of post-war commitment to finding a better way to organize healthcare, as well as a very broad, widespread social critique of health and disease.
Previous to the Spanish flu, Canada relied largely on private healthcare and charity for those who couldn't afford to pay. But during the flu, public outcry, as well as lobbying from groups like the National Council of Women of Canada and the Trade and Labor Congress, basically forced the federal government to create the Department of Health. And that was in 1919. Today, we call this department Health Canada. But to be clear, this is not Medicare, so it's not the universal health coverage that we have today. It's just a step towards it. Medicare was born in Saskatchewan decades later in 1962, and despite a lot of opposition to it at the time, within a decade, all of Canada had adopted Medicare.
I used to read everything that was laid down that was printed.
Yeah.
I can remember them all, the for and against. And
oh, really?
Yeah, there was lots of fighting about it, you know. No, people don't like new things.
Mm-hmm.
They fight new things, even if they're good for them.
Even though Medicare was eventually adopted in Canada and largely celebrated, it's been on a pretty drastic decline over the past few decades.
I don't really know whether our medical system, I feel it's outdated. It is no longer equipped to handle the number of people we have.
Almost 6 months ago, my grandma experienced some very severe heart failure. She was hospitalized and has been waiting months to get some important test results back.
For me to have to wait 5 months to get a picture of my heart, to let know what I'm capable of, what damage has been done, is ridiculous. At 100 years of age, it's just ridiculous, isn't it?
That's totally.
That's not a good system. It's not adequate.
Yep.
But I don't know if they knew about it. I guess the Americans are worse than we are.
Yeah, that's what we're told. Yeah, it's true. But, I mean, we don't have, like, in addition to long wait times that you bring up, we don't have dental or vision covered in our medical plan.
That's right. Nor hearing.
Nor hearing, yeah. So I don't know why those are not considered health issues.
The federal government has, over a course of several decades, sort of extracted itself from actually funding Medicare, you know, because it started out at 50-50 provinces and federal government. I'm not sure what it's at now, but it's very low. The whole of the 1990s was a period of retrenchment. It began before that, but it got especially bad in the 90s. And now, again, a lot of provinces are dealing with retrenchment in health funding. And in that context, it's also been very difficult to institute positive changes, especially in primary care. So it is, I think, important that be one of the things that's talked about afterward. But those conversations, I think a lot of people are afraid of them because they're afraid that they're going to undermine whatever support for Medicare is left in Canada.
Right, because you're saying by critiquing it, like, we would seem ungrateful and it could be taken away. Is that what you mean?
By critiquing it, you open the door to forces for the privatization of healthcare in Canada.
Although it's a risk to discuss the inadequacies of Medicare, Esalt thinks it's something we need to talk about, especially considering this major health crisis. And as we know, influenza pandemics in the past have galvanized Canadians to demand strength in healthcare.
Yeah, so thinking about where we're at now in this current coronavirus, are you seeing any responses to the pandemic in Canada or the world that may lead to social change, such as in housing or healthcare?
Well, it's a little bit of a tricky sort of mental process because on the one hand, I've been looking for the moment at which people's collective responses start to emerge, and I think you start to see that now, where, you know, people's basic humanity, that's the starting place for it, really, is empathy and love and compassion, and you start to see people organizing, whether that becomes tied to a broader political critique, I think very much depends on where you are.
And here in Canada, we have seen people's basic humanity emerge. For example, people have started to notice and comment on the dangers precariously employed workers are in during this crisis. But they're also in these dangers all the time. People like restaurant servers, baristas, and retail workers usually don't have paid sick leave, nor do they usually receive basic health benefits that provide coverage like free medical prescriptions and dental care. The government has promised money to help out these workers during this crisis. But what about regular upsets that happen in the daily lives of these workers? And among the disproportionately affected are women. As Moira Whiten reports in the Taiyi, women account for nearly 60% of minimum wage earners in Canada, many of whom are immigrants and women of color. With social distancing in effect, women have less access to traditional childcare support from extended family like grandparents. And it's also been widely reported that during economic recessions, there are increased rates of gender-based domestic violence. Like in 1919, today's pandemic highlights everyday inequities in our society.
So on a daily basis, it's quite easy for the average person to ignore or to not have front of mind all the time, you know, the condition of the homeless in their city, or, mm-hmm. you know, what happens to the more precariously employed people in the economy. When a larger net is cast and when more people are in a precarious situation, it of course makes people think a little bit differently about all of that.
Yeah.
But it can be used as a tool to try to force changes that are necessary for everyone.
That's interesting. Yeah. I mean, because we are seeing small movements, you know, freezes on rent. I think there's been moratorium on evictions in certain places mm-hmm. in the States. Toronto bought, you know, a hotel to house folks. Here in Vancouver, there's lots of pressure on the city government to find housing for people living in our downtown east side who are homeless yeah. or living in shelters or at our roads. That hasn't happened yet, but it just leaves you to wonder, you know, how could you undo these things once they're done too, right? Like mm-hmm. if you find housing for people who are homeless and then the emergency ends, what are you going to do? Take it away from them? So it seems
yeah.
like
well, that's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. But it mm-hmm. seems like there's this potential for this change to remain as these failures of capitalism are brought to light more clearly in this emergency.
Thank you for listening. This story was reported and produced by me, Alex DeBoer.
I said to somebody the other day, you know, what they were talking about it, and they said, you better be careful, Kay, because the elderly are not doing well. And I said, well, you know, came in with the Spanish, go out with the virus.
Special yes. thanks to Essel Jones and my grandma, Kay Burns.
I said, everybody wonders why I'm still here. I said, it takes this to get rid of me.
The music you hear is all by Blue Dot Sessions. The songs are Helfer off the album Feld, Louver off the album Holyoke, and Plaque off the album Darby.
Yeah. Thank God I have a sense of humor when I have my little depressions.